When they don't want you to win, but the soccer gods do, it's That's So MLS, a North American soccer podcast with myself, Andrew Bates, and Nick Thornton.
Hello.
Nick, how are you?
I'm so good, man. I'm excited to talk about the myriad of games that happened this weekend, although somehow I felt like there was maybe four games. There was a lot more than that, so we've got a lot to catch up on.
I was trying to pinpoint this myself because I was reasonably paying attention throughout the course of the weekend, and a couple of games snuck up on me. Is it possible that the absence of some of the teams in the CONCACAF Champions League, such as Seattle and Toronto, kind of made us forget?
Yeah, I think that's a good point. I think that might have something to do with it, because a couple of teams did have a bye week this week. I think also not helping matters is that if you're in Canada, there's really no way of watching this crap anymore, aside from a $20 a month subscription service. So there were definitely a number of games that I tried to watch, but let me just say that my provider did not follow through, and after the stream dropped about five times into the first 10 minutes of the match, I just went, you know what? Not this time.
I did dive for DAZN on week one, and therefore I was finally able to. The one thing throughout all of this hullabaloo that people had been worried about was with MLS Live jumping to ESPN's streaming service in the United States and finding a new home in Canada. I think the biggest thing people were saying is RIP the condensed game. But 90 and 20 was back in a big way. It's kind of what they're doing for Canadian teams. It's still 48 hours after, but it's good for a scenario like the Columbus-Montreal game, which I wasn't able to watch at the time. But was able to get my eyeballs on. And what a game it was.
All right, yeah, it sure was. So let's start there. Columbus and Montreal. What were your thoughts on this match? 3-2 was the final result in favor of Columbus. But what do you take away from this match?
It was really back and forth affair. It's not the only time in the weekend that somebody caught up to equalize and then ended up losing anyways. Montreal had started the game so sloppily. I think that, you know, as noted in the introduction to this episode, Columbus got a great set of circumstances with some of the events that happened. I thought that the opening penalty was obvious in terms of the grab.
Good. I thought for a second you were going to say something different. I was trying to read your facial expression, which I'm sorry that you can't see mine, but I was just sort of raising an eyebrow of like, oh, please don't let this be the first on-air fight where that's not a penalty.
But where I'm going with this is the free kick, like 3 minutes later, that led to the Gassi Sardes goal. The commentators had a grave, how could you possibly have done what appeared to me to be a somewhat pedestrian shove to the midsection.
Yeah.
That caused the Columbus player to collapse like one of the Day of the Dead skeletons when you press the button on the bottom. which, I mean, fair, it was contact, that's what it was. But I mean, I think that it was a fortunate thing for them. I feel like it might not have been the completely out of the norm in terms of shoves that I've ever seen.
Right.
But I mean, Montreal was sloppy, and it wasn't, especially early on, the Impact weren't sloppy in that sense alone, but they were able to climb back.
Yeah, no, I agree with that, the assessment on the free kick, but as you said, like, at the same time, I don't want to turn into one of those MLS fans that every time there's a call that you even slight, there's any doubt against, you're just like, no, No. It's impossible. You're like, it's within the realm of possibility. And, you know, the ref on the field has a different view than we have.
Yes.
We can watch 9 different replays at different speeds and things like that, but mm-hmm. people are checking those kinds of things. And at the end of the day, sometimes you just have to sort of say, like, okay, maybe is it the best call? No. But is it at least in the realm of fair call? Yeah, I think it is. It's much easier to do with teams that you don't have much attached to than when it's your team. So I get it. But there's no fan in the world that is going to not say that those calls are bogus, even if they have some legitimacy to them. And fair enough. But I think some people are trying to make a much bigger controversy out of this than there really is. It's a free kick. You know, does it go down easy? Yes. You see that in every league all around the world every week.
Yeah, I mean, like, let me try to at least, you know, be positive about this. I think it's great that Columbus won. I thought that, like, it's a phenomenal story, as it was last season. And, like, if anybody deserves it, it's Crew fans. You know what I mean? Like, to see, like, that is what I think is the true story so far is, you know, not high in the attendance rankings again this week, but how can you blame them for that when it's like you're a fan base that is in a cold war with its ownership?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, how do you sell seats to a team that may not be around next season? Mm-hmm. Although I have a feeling that's going to be harder and harder to do if Columbus keeps stringing together results. But I wanted to start us off with a note here that I think might become a theme for this week's games, and that have Montreal had promising moments.
Yes. But,
you know, there was good runs of play. Raheem Edwards with the volley, that goal was absolutely superb. He had just had so much to have to do on that, and somehow still stuck it in. Good for Montreal. It was good to see some fight in them, because there was points in the game where you really felt like that wasn't going to show up. But my point here is that Montreal especially looked very preseason, and I imagine a number of these coaches and managers are going to be looking at how they prepared their teams for the MLS season and maybe rethinking how they approach it, because there's a number of teams, and we've seen this in some of the scorelines, teams that are getting beaten that I think mid-season are not going to be getting beaten by the same scoreline and are going to tighten things up a little bit. Mm-hmm. We know Montreal has a problem seeing games out, but to me this just looks like a team that is very much in preseason. There's glimmers of hope and some brilliant singular examples of skill, but defending-wise, I mean, to give it up so late in the game, another obvious penalty.
Yeah.
Maybe a little bit lighter, but, you know, Raheem Edwards, I think he scored like 4 minutes earlier, is now the villain at the other end in just a clumsy, clumsy tackle in the box that you're just thinking, like, just why?
Well, this is the charmed life. This is the charmed life for Columbus fans that are watching this game, because what I seem to observe is that whatever the distance was between the two of them, his foot, he hits while running forward, he hits the defender's, he hits the attacker's foot with his foot and then trips forward over the attacker. So he's not tripping. He did not actually.
Yeah, Edwards tripped himself.
Yes.
In doing so, fouled another player.
And it's just, you can see the look on Remy Gard's face. It, like, this is what happens. We talked in the preview about the team getting younger. You put people in positions and then you stick by them. Unfortunately, sometimes they trip over themselves.
Indeed they do. However, one bright takeaway from me is that Zardes is thriving.
Yes.
And I believe this is now 3 goals for him in the first 2 games. Mm-hmm. And hopefully there's more to come. But it seems like he really does have he has a new lease on life here in his new club.
Yes. Also, I did want to see that Edwards' goal was really pretty. So it's not like putting that focus on him has been bad.
No, I want to highlight is part of the reason why I think Montreal looks like they're still in preseason. As you see those kinds of things happen in preseason where a team is not without its successes. It's not always polished all over the park, but that's the kind of thing you'd expect to see in preseason, or indeed with a very young squad, is somebody like Raheem Edwards stepping up and scoring a brilliant goal out of nothing, although it was a very good cross as well, and then just a really clumsy penalty given on the other end of the park, that you go, this is not the kind of inconsistent performance you can suffer too much of in the regular season.
Yeah.
That they have to tighten up those things pretty quickly. It's early days. I think, you know, if you're Montreal, you walk away from that and say, hey, good for us to fight back, but defensively we need to do more and be a little bit more switched on, and they could easily compete this season.
As noted, Columbus drew 11,098 to that game with 13,305 to New England. At the other end of the attendance scale was a new record.
Philadelphia.
Yes.
Oh, wait, no. No.
Atlanta. It wasn't them. Drew 72,035 to the Mercedes-Benz Stadium. What did you think of that game?
The first note I have for this game is, does attendance matter? But I think I meant it kind of cheekily in that, and I don't think it's fair to necessarily compare Columbus and Atlanta, and I'm not saying
no.
That's what you're trying to do either, but
this was a segue.
You have to, it's a segue. It's a fill. It's a good one. It's just a bit, guys. It's a link. You have to acknowledge what an incredible accomplishment this is and how massively Atlanta has pulled through and supported its team. And, it might come somewhat unexpected after their team got thoroughly thrashed on opening day. I mean, of course, it is the season home opener, but you wouldn't necessarily fault it if it was only 65,000 on opening day because they really beefed it in their opener. But clearly, this is just. I mean, I don't want to say it's the bar being set. But it certainly does make you view MLS in a slightly different way. I mean, there's a lot of very fine, world-class clubs around the world that can't draw that. And Atlanta seemed to set themselves up well. In terms of the actual game, I'm glad that they noted this. DC beat them three times last season in all three of their encounters.
Yes.
So Atlanta was actually kind of the underdog coming into this match. Obviously, they've made some lineup changes. Final scoreline is 3-1. Atlanta looked in control for a lot of it, but I think that belies some of the work that DC United was doing. At the end of the day, for me, the strength of Atlanta is still their movement in bodies on the pitch and their movement of the ball. Their passing is just a little bit more slick than what we've seen from other teams. Not necessarily pinpoint accuracy, but they're moving the ball with some speed, and they're moving it into space, and those players are getting into space quickly. And United had chances. You know, Darren Maddox finishes one off towards the end of the match.
It's good for Maddox because I was happy to see him score that goal, because as much as it's a familiar story for him to as much as sometimes it's familiar to see him struggle a little bit from his time in Vancouver, it's great to see him do well.
Absolutely. And just a heads up, positive strikers positioning, like an absolute poaching of a goal. It was in the right place at the right time. DC United has got a lot to be looking forward to, and I think some of the energy behind them getting into their new stadium will help. I think one of the reasons why Houston beat Atlanta is because they beat them at their own game. Is Houston can move the ball quickly, and they can move their players quickly up and down the pitch. That, to me, is the key to unlocking Atlanta. Atlanta can certainly be beat, but they can turn on you really quickly. And when you see the strike that Almiron had from just outside the box, that, I mean, you barely even saw it leave his foot. It flew into the net so quickly. Atlanta's also just a little bit more clinical in their finishing, and you really see how much they've got three or four great attacking players, and defenders are drawn towards them, but in doing so, they necessarily leave somebody open. And if that's Almiron on the top of the box, he'll rocket those home all day.
Mm-hmm.
What were your thoughts of the match, though?
Well, I think from that, you can't... the thing about... When you're talking about moving the players around, that's the thing about this 3-5-2, is that it does create a lot of space in the back, but if you're playing a team that's doing the 4-1-4-1 thing, you're going to have a little bit better of a shot, because that's not necessarily you essentially can't soak up pressure and expect success.
Yeah, and you see the fluidity of Atlanta's midfield and how much they're, if you are stacked up as just that four at the back and four in the middle, you can kind of move through them. It should, in theory, cancel that out, but when you've got those five, the bank of five midfielders that can swap out back and forth, you just seem to always have space, and you're playing those tight triangles.
Mm-hmm.
And we saw this the whole game, and I actually thought DC did quite well to close them down as good as they did. I think there's a lot of other teams that would have given up, and in some cases they nearly did, two or three more goals.
Mm-hmm. We say this because... because we love David Ostad, and it could have been a better outing for him. Not that I thought that he did particularly poorly, but just, you know, it's tough when you're on the other side of that kind of a scoreline.
It sure is, but I thought he had a good game, and I thought overall DC played well. And it's interesting because, of course, a 3-1 scoreline always seems like it says a lot more than a 2-1 scoreline. But really, that can be, you know, one mistake here or there, and all of a sudden it looks like you got blown out. I actually thought DC played very well and held their own for much of the game. Atlanta clearly had the momentum behind them, but still a beatable team. And Maddox showed that as well, is that, speaking about preseason form, that was one where the defenders just went a little to sleep and weren't really paying attention, and Maddox found the pocket and got in there. No credit taken away from him for the run, but it did seem a rather easy goal for DC to get.
What if a 2-1 scoreline says one thing, mm-hmm. and a 3-1 scoreline says another thing? What does a 5-1 scoreline say?
Are we talking about Colorado, New England? Oh no, of course we're talking about LAFC and Real Salt Lake. I don't know. You got to go first on this one, man.
Well, you last week talked about how Diego Rossi could be a really real breakout star.
Me and every other soccer pundit.
Yeah, I mean, sure, it's a hot take, but I mean,
me alone.
but you know, they showed that they have a lot of different. Offensive threats. They show that they are moving the ball well from the back through to the attack. We saw Steven Betisher have a great assist.
Yep.
And mastermind a scoring chance. RSL had RSL got things going, sure, but with a penalty kick. But after that point, it seemed really tough for them to mount any kind of resistance.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's funny, it was just as I was watching highlights again to get myself up to speed on everything, I just saw an article on the front page of MLSsoccer.com, and it's like, LAFC, the best expansion side ever. You're like, it's been fucking two games. I'm like, okay, I get it, but it's been two games.
I also agreed. I also liked Offside X2, why RSL have a right to be steamed. It was a 5-1 game. I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah, but it changed the tide of the game, man. Oh, yeah. Fuck that business. It looks offside, but my other thing is like, but they're reviewing it. And I don't want to overput faith in the VAR system, but it's like, they're seeing different angles than what we see at home when they're doing video assistant review, we don't see everything that they're seeing on a screen. And at some point you have to go, it was reviewed and it was decided that it was onside. But also, as you say, it's kind of a moot point. And I honestly don't think that goal changed the tide of things. RSL struggled to defend this whole match. The only bright spot was Plata's penalty, which he did miss and then hit the rebound off of. But the whole game, you know, I'm looking at it and I'm looking at the defenders and they're just standing still. And LAFC has an incredibly fast-paced team from the back to the front. And they're just running circles around RSL. So, offside, sure. So, it ends 4-1 instead of 5-1. The result would have been one goal less, and that's it. And I feel fairly convinced in that. The speed of LAFC is truly kind of frightening. However, they're looking very much like Atlanta looked last season, in that they can score a lot of goals, they've got a lot of speed. But we haven't really yet seen them, because it's only been two games, stack up against a competitor that can bring what LAFC brings to it.
No. No, there definitely hasn't been the sort of long-term... nothing has been proven. We've seen the flashes of brilliant-looking attacking that will... That sort of will be great for promotion, but we don't know how they we don't really yet know how they respond to adversity.
Exactly, and that's a perfect point, because you know it's easy to sing the praises of Diego Rossi now, and I think he's good for 10, 12, maybe 15 goals this season. But as he's a 20-year-old striker, it's his first time in the league. Maybe he does fantastically well, and he could, and I hope he does. But two games in, okay, he's got three goals and I believe an assist to his name. That's great. But as we've seen time and time and time and time and time again with young strikers and new strikers in MLS, he could not score again till June.
Mm-hmm.
That's a real possibility in MLS. And it's not to rain on anybody's parade or not give credit to the extreme talent that Rossi has. And I do think he brings something different than a lot of other new incomers to MLS that we've seen. But yeah, at this point to call, we're like, are they title contenders? Come on. Like, as you said, we haven't seen them in adversity. I want to see what they look like when they're 3-0 down. Because it'll happen at some point this season. The thing I will say is that the great promise to their team is they're set up so defensively strong that they really did do their homework, and they're not a traditional MLS expansion side, in that they got some veteran defenders. And as we saw, the value of Betashur again, a lot of teams don't want to pay that salary. He's the best right back in MLS. Hands down, bar none, he's the best in MLS. And he's the best for a reason. And sure, he only got the one assist, but the number of times you heard his name, it doesn't take a lot of switching around channels to hear that, you know, fullbacks in MLS don't have their names called out as often, like they're the midfield number 10 stringing plays together. But Betashur just always seems to be in the right place at the right time and is picking up exactly where he left off.
Yep.
And the other thing I'll say about LAFC is they seem to have great team chemistry. For a brand new team, they seem to want to play for each other. But as you said, they're also riding a high right now. So I'm excited to see what happens when they're 2-0 down away from home and maybe missing a key player or two.
Well, this is the kind of, and I think that this applies a little bit to Atlanta too, where they are teams that are exciting right now. And because if you're exciting and you could promote the image of being exciting, well, you don't really need to think about anything else, do you? Right? Like, and it's good in the moment. And it's like, obviously it's been sustaining for Atlanta. You see how it pans out over time for LAFC, but it seems to have resulted in some positive chemistry with as much as it's not like we've seen expansion teams, take a couple seasons to gel, in the past, But I think that now it's almost like there's no baggage.
Right. Yeah. One, and you're starting with that excitement and momentum, and I think that's a little different than some of the other teams that in previous years have come into MLS. It's sort of like a bit of a slow trickle into the league, mm-hmm. and a sort of tentativeness, and now all of a sudden it's, you know, you've got a new stadium, and the city's behind you, and you're excited. I mean, you know, I was there for Vancouver Whitecaps entering MLS, and it was nothing like LAFC or Orlando or Atlanta entering MLS. It's just sort of like, oh, okay, we have a sock team here. You know, maybe we'll see what happens. Oh, we only won 4 games? Well, you know, it's only the first season. I think the expectations have changed, especially with fans, but I don't expect this to be the case for every single MLS team that enters the league now.
No, it's a big combination, a combination push of promotion of PR and football operations working together, kind of.
Indeed, however, some blowouts you just can't ignore. And
wow.
The other end of the spectrum,
just
of teams doing very well. You have a team in the Pacific Northwest who just can't seem to buy a break. Portland versus New York Red Bulls, 4-0.
A weakened New York Red Bulls who had 9 changes in the starting 11 because of the CONCACAF Champions League game tomorrow, or as we record this, probably today as you listen, or as per your style. It's a little flooring. One of the players that establishes the two nil lead is Bradley Wright Phillips, so that's not exactly a rookie. But Ben Mies became the third youngest MLS player to score.
Yeah, he's 17, right?
Yes.
Hats off, kid. I only hate you a little.
I don't know if it was in total or in the history of the Red Bulls, so more on that later. But, yeah. Whew.
Also his debut as well.
Yeah.
Not a bad way to start the season. My note here was the kids are all right. Which I'm sure other people have said many times over. But, okay. Zoom back out of this is, let's remember, Portland Timbers have a new coach this season and are in a new era.
Yes.
They're missing Darlington Nagbe. They're trying to find their style. And this very much looked like a team trying to find their style and their identity. The big question mark to me, or the possible concern is, I automatically went, well, that's Diego Valeri. He'll get the team to rally around him because he's a wizard. And it'll just happen. And it's hard to recall a Portland game where I've heard his name less and he's been so so less influential on a game. And that New York Red Bulls, yeah, maybe riding a bit of a wave of momentum of just having a whole bunch of new players out on the field, but it wasn't just like youthful speed and exuberance, as they were playing with an exceptional sharpness. And Portland just looked utterly lost. And my only other note here on this game is just incredibly, incredibly poor defending, flat-footedness, failure to see the players in the box, and just marking all over the place. It's not really a surprise that this one ended 4-0. New York Red Bulls had a great game and took their chances, and credit to all the players that scored, but Portland never really looked in this one. And, you know, I only hope that this poor start to the season doesn't... I hope it does affect them for the whole season because they're the enemy team. You know, I want to see the new look Timbers. I want to see them create something and do something different from what they've done. Because Caleb Porter got them to a certain place, and I feel like they've sort of just been slightly underachieving for a number of years. Despite obvious successes.
Mm.
But maybe not fully reaching their potential. And they're looking for a new style of play. It's a new era for them.
I think, and maybe it's a, maybe it is a deal to do with, maybe it does have something to do with the new coach and needing to have an opportunity for Savarese to put his mark on the team. Maybe there's not, we've highlighted teams that haven't really made a, we've highlighted teams that haven't made a kind of a good enough effort to add something new.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that's something that as players leave Portland, that maybe they haven't done new things to account for that.
Mm-hmm.
But it's they don't have a lot going at the moment, even though they were their possession was they were leading in possession in that game, 56.7. They had possession for great stretches of the game, but they just couldn't do anything with it.
Yeah, this is another team for me that I just go, it's preseason for them still. I expect Portland will do much better in the coming weeks, but they looked very out of sorts. They looked tired. They looked just not like they anybody really knew quite where they needed to be. And you know, there's a few bright points, but really nothing much to write about besides the scoreline in this one really does kind of tell the final story.
Yeah. I'm looking here. I'm seeing that they had when you compare sort of the crossing, they had very few successful the crossing into the box was not great at all for them, I think.
Yeah, and that's interesting is that if you look at those stats from the game, it matches up quite evenly with New York Red Bulls. Like it's a pretty even number of tackles won, et cetera. But it's the crosses into the box that really starts to show their weakness. But when you look at the goals, you know, that there's a number of them that are the second or third chance and just poor clearances of the ball and just giving too many opportunities and or not marking. And it's like, you know, for God's sakes, have we not figured out in MLS? Take nothing away from Bradley Wright Phillips. But if you can't win a header on Bradley Wright Phillips in the box and you allow him to get onto it, he's gonna score a goal.
Yeah,
like you can jump up, you can head that ball away from him, put two guys on him if you have to, but it was really poor defending in on set pieces as well.
Yeah. One thing that I got a chance to watch a little bit of New York City versus LA. I do think that they improved. Speaking of teams that are looking to get things going this year, I thought LA was improved. I thought they, I thought that once they conceded the red, it kind of took the wind out of their sails. But they had they were able to get something going. New York City just continues to look impressive.
Yeah, I agree. That's more or less what I put to for this game is. David Villa does what David Villa does. And I feel bad for not paying more attention to him in previous seasons and just sort of writing him off as like, yeah, he scores goals, but he's playing against ship players and whatever. And it's the Eastern Conference. But as the Eastern Conference has grown so much stronger and so quickly, you really do begin to see that, of course, he's in his later years and he's nowhere near his prime, but yet he still is undoubtedly one of the best players in MLS and really as we talked about last week, how do you defend against that guy in any league?
Mm-hmm.
Once the ball is on his feet, he just pulls the strings. And I agree. I thought LA did much better this week and saw kind of what they can do, and they did get the goal and made it a little bit difficult for New York City, but just an awful lot of ball watching in the box. Again, with the rebounds coming out and everybody's just standing around and looking for the ball rather than moving and marking the players. And I actually felt that they were a little bit fortunate to escape this one with only a 2-1 loss because I thought there was a number of chances that they had.
Yeah.
And we also saw, I think, another big weakness that could really prove to be a continuing Achilles heel for LA is that with a lack of on-field leadership, You leave players like Ashley Cole exposed, just getting extremely frustrated. And, you know, the second yellow was, it was minimal contact, but you could see the frustration in him, and he had to make a number of tactical fouls just to keep LA in the game. And I think it's a fair red to send him off, or second yellow, because of the persistence of fouls, but the persistence of fouls he needed to give, because at times he's the only defender there, and he's playing center back when he's supposed to be a fullback, because the defenders are just off doing whatever else. It was just, you know, across the board it wasn't terrible, but there's still just moments of remarkably poor defending from LA Galaxy that you feel like, okay, New York City is a great team, and they capitalized on that, but you feel like an awful number of teams are going to do the same thing. And, you know, when I think about the new look San Jose, etc., or the speed and agility of Houston, I go, there's a lot of Western Conference teams that could fare quite well against this LA Galaxy side if they don't tighten things up at the back and develop some leadership from the back. Mm-hmm. It just seems to be awfully quiet back there, and a lot of standing around waiting for somebody else to do something.
Well, this is the issue, though, is, and this is maybe a little bit of my career-long gripe with Ashley Cole, is that do we blame it on, you know, are the players not there to play beside him, or not being organized by the coach or the goalkeeper? Or if you're looking for somebody to be a leader, I don't know that you could look past him in thinking it's obviously very frustrating, but he hasn't had that kind of, you know, core of the team. You haven't got the sense that he's the core of the team, even though he's, you know, one of the most experienced players there.
Yeah, I agree. But he's not a cap. Like, I mean, he is the captain, but he's not an on-field leader, and you can see it. And I don't mean that as any knock against him, and I've never been a big fan of his, but I've grown to appreciate what he offers to a club. He needs leaders playing alongside him. And I get that it can also be a lonely position to be the only on-field leader on a team where you're trying to get your team into it, and you're trying to, you know, close down the game, and you're trying to slow down the game. But I honestly think I understand the frustration here. I don't see how his team is working for him. Yeah, as the captain, you have to get people inspired. But at this point, if you see Ashley Cole playing and playing the way that he does, and that doesn't inspire you to do better and tighten things up, I don't know what will. Mm. He's also not a very vocal player. And in MLS, I think that's ultimately what you need. And a captain at fullback, I don't know if that's necessarily the right call to make. Mm-hmm. I think it makes sense to have Ashley Cole as the captain. But, you know, I think ultimately you want your captain to be in the center of the park. And you don't see Ashley Cole talking to players on the pitch and barking orders. And I think he's kind of relying on people to know what to do, and it's clear that they don't.
Mm. In that game, we saw David Villa's 100th goal for in MLS. We also saw in the Houston-Vancouver game, Kai Kamara scored his – oh, no, that was last week. Fuck.
No, it was this
– Was that it? This week? No.
I think it was this week, wasn't it?
Yes.
Yeah, I think
it's
this week.
Right, yes.
300 MLS games, 100 MLS goals.
I was forgetting the date. It was just the debut was the milestone last week. But yes, Kai Kamara scored his 100th goal.
He did indeed. This one was a bit of a surprise to me, even as a Vancouver Whitecaps fan. Especially considering Houston's blowout of Atlanta the week before. Long day of travel.
Mm-hmm.
Stefan Marinovic battling flu all week. I would have been quite happy with a point out of this game. Of course, I want my team to win, but I wasn't expecting much out of this. Very few teams have ever won in Houston. Ours never has.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when a very clear and obvious penalty gets awarded, Kai Kamara takes it nice and neatly. Elise does what Elise does and gets into the box. And we just saw a little bit of flopping around, which I'll get to in a second. Mm-hmm. But once again, eating humble pie, Breck Shea with, you know, a little hold-up ball from Kamara that just sneaks through to him, and then Shea makes something of it. And I didn't really realize this until a commentator said it, but Breck Shea does finish his chances.
Yes.
If he gets on that, his crosses aren't always beautiful. Defensively, he's often out of position or doesn't make the right play. But if he gets through on that breakaway, Breck Shea is putting that goal in the back of the net. He's very good at doing that. And that becomes the game winner.
I think it's great. I think that as much as Vancouver's position right now is a little weird DP-wise, I don't even know if he's still technically the DP, but like,
I believe he is.
He's certainly not one of the key players, so people wonder about this. But so people sometimes wonder about his continued presence, but he adds so much depth to a team. And I don't, is that justified with a price? Who could say? But I, you know, it's great for that he is there in these situations when I think it is lucky for Vancouver, first of all, to have played Houston in Houston in May instead of in the melting heat of August. But also, you know, to make it out of there with a win, you look to a player like Shea to take that opportunity when it presents itself.
Yeah, and when you look at the options on the bench, you kind of go, I think it's only Breck Shea that could kind of do that for them in that instance, right? I mean, he doesn't necessarily have the speed, but he has the poise. And it would be easy to think, throw on somebody like Mosqueda to go in and get creative. But really, I think the direct approach was what they needed, right? Is they needed somebody to sit out on the wing and wait for the ball and beat Houston defense, which we know is beatable. My question to you is, and this, you know, is maybe just a little bit of my bias as a defender, albeit a poor one. What did you think of the Whitecaps' defense in this game? Because this was not a comfortable win.
No, and this is what... So we were talking a little bit about this wanting to... About, from last week's play, being happy to have seen the back of sort of this soak up the pressure style attack. And it was a 67% to 33% possession game for Houston. Houston got like 21. It was like the shots were 21-7. You could give the credit, though, I think a little bit to the defense for having the 8 shot blocks to sort of make that a little bit making that a little bit easier. The fact that Houston had so much going forward and they couldn't lay a cross in makes the end result so baffling. What were you going to say?
No, I was just going to say that I thought Aaron Mond and Kendall Waston did an excellent job of keeping those crosses out of the box, and I think they had to eat 6 or 7 blocks each in that game, which is pretty incredible.
Especially because Marcel DeJong had to leave the game with a chest contusion, which was just awful. It was a really nervy moment because he went down holding his chest. In spitting up, like just spitting, and it's that has meant bad things before. I was really worried for a minute. It is great to see that he's fine. He was he went to the hospital. He's seeing the doctor, but apparently he's okay.
Yeah, it's pretty terrifying, and you know, especially that. Yeah, they pulled the camera out pretty quickly when they saw he was coughing up blood. And you know, it's a physical game and a lot can happen, but that I agree. It went from sort of just like, oh, what's going on? And then to see the replay that there's no player around him and he just starts clutching his chest is, you know, I'm in the era of seeing Premier League players carted off the field non-responsive. And, you know, it was definitely a nervy moment, but it's good to hear he's on the mend. He flew back with the team and obviously we wish him well. Prior to that, I did feel like him and Nowinski were really struggling to keep up pace on the wings. And the Elise goal is it's hard to say. Like, what do you really do about a strike like that from such close distance? But I did feel when you see defenders drop to the ground because you think the player's going to hit it low, but just sort of almost dive out of the way of the ball. I know it's easy to say after the fact because we've all been there. You're trying to defend a shot like that.
Yes.
And part of you is just thinking, like, get out of the way! I felt like Nowinski and De Jong really struggled here. And I thought that Brett Levi was ready to go. And so I was quite surprised when I heard he was still recovering. And I obviously hadn't followed that storyline. And I'm just thinking, like, oh, shit, are we about to put Breck Shea on as left back?
And in fact!
In fact, they swap out Shea and Davies, and Davies plays probably the best 30 minutes of soccer I think I've ever seen him play, because the amount of distance he traveled up and down that pitch, I mean, there's a one point where he has to track all the way back from attacking to defend, does it, closes down the ball, and then all of a sudden gets all the way back to the other end to create an attacking chance in the span of 20, 25 seconds.
Mm.
And not that, and Carl Robinson's made this quite clear, is this is not a position they want to be playing Davies in unless they absolutely have to. But credit to him, I thought he did fantastically well and put in as good of a performance as I've seen out of Jordan Harvey or Sam Adekube in their time in that position.
Yeah, I think that the because he's such a, there's obviously a lot of expectation piled on Davies, and because he's such an exciting player on the attack, the strength of his game can be sometimes boiled down to, like, does he have chances, does he finish the chances? But he's great on the ball. He's very composed when he's got to be.
Yeah, I agree, and he showed that. And I'd be one of those people that's been very guilty of only really seeing that one side of his game, because we haven't had many chances to see the other side. But he did himself a fantastic credit, and really, I think that was one of the games where I went, okay, if there's scouts watching, this is the kind of thing they want to see. Mm-hmm. Not necessarily the box-to-box dribble through defenders and, you know, getting the cross in, or in this season's case, even scoring the goal. But the fact that he has that kind of work rate and knew what to do. He knew that position.
Yeah.
And he played it a couple of times before. But there's a lot of players, especially young players, who have that sort of prodigal quality. And find themselves really only playing for one position. But especially in Europe these days, you see, like, the ability to be flexible, the ability to play anywhere, serves a player incredibly well. If you're just fast down the wing and you're just a player that can get into the box, that's actually not good enough anymore. Not for a first team in England or elsewhere. And that was kind of one of the ones where I went, oh, I think now I finally see where what other people have been saying about the potential here, we've just seen some of it in action.
Yes.
Not just the potential, but we've actually seen it play out on the field.
Definitely. I think that one of the things that this season is going to make clear is that we haven't seen anything close to the best of Davies. That, like, as much as things have been, like, sort of exciting so far, like, this is still the build right? This is still where you look down 5 years in the 5 years down the line. Somebody, sometime he has to do some defense, and somebody thinks, "Remember that game?
Yeah,
back in remember that or either back in Vancouver or remember that game back in 2018 when he like all of a sudden was just drafted back into the left back role." This is still the experience building that will create the final product.
Absolutely. And the question is, where's the ceiling for him? And right now, there doesn't really seem to be one if he continues to grow and develop. And the exciting part, of course, is you go, if this is the kind of intelligence he can show on that end of the pitch now at 17, what does that look like when he's 22? What does that look like when he's 25, when he goes to other clubs and gets different types of experience? If anything, I hope this experience kind of gets drilled into his head of, you know, okay, maybe he wants to be a winger and a goal scorer. I'm not saying he should be a left-back player, but that is the kind of mentality you need to have to succeed in Europe, is that you need to play absolutely anywhere that the coach puts you and understand that position and be able to do it well. Mm. And it was really great to see a young player not put his head down and, you know, just do the bare minimum and try to defend. He actually did his homework, knew what he needed to do, and wasn't just athletic. Had, as you said, great skill on the ball and did a great credit to himself and to his team.
Absolutely. What else did I get to see this week? I saw the highlights for Orlando, Minnesota. That was fine. Minnesota did great to get themselves the win. Did you have any thoughts on that particular encounter?
My only thoughts are the Molino-Finley connection proves to be very strong, and it's just very unfortunate that now Molino, as of today, is out for the rest of the season with an ACL injury.
Oh, I hadn't seen that.
No, and they didn't show the actual moment of the injury in the highlights, but I saw part of the game and I saw him go down and it was sort of questionable about what went on. But it is a torn ACL and he's done. It's just so unfortunate for Minnesota because I feel like this is a team that's done so many things right and they've really relied on him to kind of be the talisman. And I'm sure the team will respond and move funds around and do what they need to do to cover. But Molino has been an excellent MLS player, as we know, and certainly for Minnesota, a bright spot in an otherwise pretty underwhelming opening season. And it's just a horrible thing to see as any fan of a sport. You don't want to see a top player go down with a season-ending injury.
That is really rough. I hope that Minnesota can put something together because it's been interesting to see how they build over the course of their second season. I was ready to write off New England, Colorado until the hilarious ending sequence, which I tweeted at you or I texted you about as soon as it happened because nothing was happening. I watched I watched like the last. I think when I tuned back in, it was 1-1, and nothing of particular interest was occurring. And then in stoppage time, deep in stoppage time, there's this free kick, and they are standing, and they're looking at each other, and Gundez is scoring over the standing over the ball, and he's talking to somebody else. They're talking to him, and the camera whips to Brad Friedel, and it's like, all of a sudden, it's Chris Tierney who takes a sneaky free kick that hits the top of the wall.
Yeah.
And goes right in. It was the free kick location, the commentators were even like, is this too close to actually be able to get a good shot in? And it almost was because it didn't hit the wall, but it went from a solid point on the road from Colorado to nothing in rapid
time. Yeah, and this is one that upon closer inspection, and good for New England for not having any players sent off in this match. essentially operating with two backup two backup center backs, which also tells you something else. But, oh, man. Yeah, this one was like watching two different sets of very boring tones of beige dry on the wall. It wasn't a good game. The marking, again, from Colorado was just so poor. So poor. I mean, Fagundes is a great player, and he scores goals, and we know that. It's great. It's a good goal from him. There's nobody near him! There's three players around one player, and Fagundes is open at the top of the box. It's just like... again, it's easier to watch the game than to play the game, and I think that New England and Colorado both have bright points to their teams, but it's going to be a long season for both those sets of fans, because as you said, there really wasn't much to watch here. A poorly taken penalty as well could have resulted in more. I will say that, you know, it's good to see players in their rookie debuts get goals.
Mm-hmm.
That's one bright spot for New England anyway.
Mm-hmm.
But Colorado just looked like the same Colorado we've seen time and time and time again. They look exactly the same as last season. They do a couple of things right, but it ultimately feels like it's a MLS team playing a college team.
Mm.
That they've got some speed and they've got some talent, but just hopeless. No real plan, no organization on the pitch, no leadership. And New England beat them. Sure, they capitalized on it, but I feel like they did get kind of lucky off of the hit off of the wall for the free kick. But New England did not look good for much of this match either. And just both teams really seeming to lack any sort of real creativity or motive going forward. And this is one of those results where you go, okay, New England wins 2-1 or Colorado wins 2-1. What does that mean over the whole season? What does that mean going into the next match? I kind of feel like not much.
They're kind of each conference's counterpart to each other.
Yeah.
As noted, Toronto and Seattle have the week off as they go to Mexico to play in the CCL. Toronto going to Tigres and getting that day off after the Whitecaps didn't last year. I'm not mad. Mm-hmm. It's actually quite funny to me.
I can tell. we're missing one game though, but I think
we
can
start
up quickly.
Go. Yeah.
Chicago, Sporting KC.
Oh, how did I forget this? This was actually quite good.
Well, it's pretty easy to forget 7-goal games in MLS. I don't know what your take on is. I'm sorry. I feel like I'm steamrolling you, but I'm just tired and I wrote notes, so I'm prepared.
Yeah, absolutely. absolutely.
I feel like I should. I'm reflecting on my other podcast where I'm supposed to ask more questions. And this one, I'm just like, get the thoughts out before your brain shuts down.
Yes, absolutely.
Although I do that on that one too. So Chicago loses 4-3 to Sporting KC at home. This one to me was just another preseason game. Like,
yeah,
great to see what Sporting KC could pull together and win out of this. But holy shit, did both teams just look really scattered? And there was no defending in this game, none. It was absolutely shocking. And when you think about guys like Kapelhoff that have been and what's the guy on Sporting KC? Starts with an M.
Madranda?
Madranda, thank you. And Madranda got a goal as well. But you think of these titans of defending. Chicago and Sporting KC have excellent defending records, especially at home. But this was just a game of a battle of wills. And I don't want to take too much away from SKC for getting that win. But yeah, again, a season that could be full of a lot of ups and downs. Nikolic gets his goals. But ultimately, my only takeaway from this is, and I watched part of this game and I watched the highlights and I went back a few times and I went, there's nothing here of note other than the fact that there were 7 goals. But the defending was so atrocious. I don't know what else you take away from it other than like, well, yes, that would happen if you're defending like that and you're not actually marking up in the box on set plays and watching the runs in. Like, this to me was another example of teams that just really shit the bed this week on defending. But both teams did it. One team did a slightly better job of putting in goals.
When you compare last week to this week, and sort of the... it was great to see the Schweinsteiger connection working again for Chicago. Would you say almost... I didn't think that last year, and maybe that was just because of David Akin also being around. I wouldn't say they were a one-man team last year, but it kind of felt in this game that they were a little reliant to hook up to the Nikolic fire hose.
Yeah. Oh, the Nikolic fire hose. Did you make that up?
I did.
That's good. I like that. Like a Nikolic fire hose. It's not so MLS. I agree. And I love Nikolic. Nikolic is a defender. He's a striker after my own heart. It's simple. It's always simple with him. He scores some great goals, but he's always just in the right place. Simple little tap-ins. He's ready for the rebounds. He's watching. He's poaching. That's how he won the Golden Boot. But, yeah, I agree. Is that how much are they going to rely on that throughout the season? And we saw last season how it didn't really amount to much. Like, it was kind of a powerful fart in the wind. Sort of lost amongst the noise. Of like, okay, you've got the Golden Boot winner, but you guys can't make it into preseason because you don't have a cohesive team. And for me, that starts defensively. And I think the argument that people are trying to make for a team like LAFC is if you can get a team scoring like that with as good of a back line as they have, then that becomes really dangerous. Mm-hmm. But Chicago seems to have not really improved much on that back line. A back line that 2-3 years ago was one of the best in MLS now seems to just be awfully porous. And maybe it's just, again, preseason blues, early days. But some of those balls in, you're just like, no one's there out of that. Like, Kapelhoff's not cleaning that up? Really? Like, it just seemed to be a little bit uncertain. And, you know, Sporting KC added to their attacking prowess over the offseason. But this is a team that really struggled to score goals last season. And I felt like they were given a tremendous amount of respect and space to move in this game that they really didn't deserve. Mm. And it's hard to imagine teams like a high-flying San Jose, LAFC, Vancouver, etc., don't just continue to capitalize on that, including Houston.
I definitely agree. I think that the most salient thing I can pick out is this continuing feeling of this preseason notion that you have that for some teams they are just not set up right now, and it could be that other teams that seem to be either in their doldrums or super put together can still get derailed. So it's weird because the games count, but sometimes in a scenario like this, it doesn't seem like either squad really is the team they hope to be by the end of the year.
No. And the point I'll add, too, is it's great to see our team, Vancouver, doing well. Mm-hmm. But the opposite is true as well. You see teams come flying out of the gates, performing really well, and then hit that mid-season slump. So as much as I'm saying that against teams like Colorado, like New England, like Chicago, in, 5 or 6 games they pick up and the teams that are hot right now start to slip. And we saw that last season as well. So I don't want to read too much into it. I'm just saying as of right now, for a few teams, it's kind of like, okay, it's time to hit the training pitch proper and start working on some set plays and some defending.
Yes. For next week, I'm looking at the matchups. I'm most interested in Montreal and Toronto, obviously. Yeah. New York City and Orlando could be good, but I'm still waiting. Merrim looked good in the loss for Orlando, so
he did have a couple. He had a couple of looks. I feel like Orlando's yet to click in, but I think that's coming.
Those are my look aheads to next week. Who is your team of the week?
Oh, yeah, the thing I suggested we do and then I didn't think about again after I suggested it. I mean, the easy option is to say LAFC, but I feel like my team of the week is going to be the New York Red Bulls, which I know is sacrilege here in Vancouver, but considering the number of changes, and even though Portland's been out of form, I think that is a masterful performance and a good look of things to come. They've lost two of their key midfielders in the last 2 years, and people talk about them as a team being gutted. But it wasn't just the attackers that won that game for them. And if they can continue to bring up this talent, and you look at the number of homegrown talent players on that team, that could be really, really exciting. And so this is the team that made me sit up this week and go, okay, I need to learn more about these players and watch more about them, because they clearly have potential, and Portland is no slouch, even though they've started slowly. Who's your team of the week?
My team of the week, because I'm also going to ignore LAFC, is Columbus. I think it's a fantastic story. Not only, I feel like the fact that this team has had so many off-the-pitch issues obscures that this is a team that went to the conference final last year and on the pitch has to formulate an answer to that, and they've done so in great fashion.
Yeah.
It was, as I said, I did think a lucky result, but in an Eastern Conference where things have not taken shape as of yet in terms of who's going to be dominant, who are going to be the contenders, who are they going to be the teams to beat, you could do worse than to find ways to win in this fashion.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. And if Zardes continues to deliver, again, it's easy to be like, he scored 3 goals in 2 games. He's the new Messiah. He's going to score 20 goals. He could go another 2 months without scoring. But I like the new... I keep just thinking, like, the new lease on life. And I feel like it's like when you see a pet get adopted out to a better family. I don't want to sound patronizing to the angle on that, but I just, as you pointed out, Zardes really, really got thrown under the bus last season in LA, and it's just great to see him come back and start strong, and he seems to have the exact right focus. And the interviews I've seen with him too, he seems focused on the team, and that's the first thing he talks about. But he's no slouch. He knows what this league is about, and I think we're going to see a lot more goals from him. And I'm excited to see that. I don't want to be on the receiving end of it, and hopefully, knowingly, Vancouver won't be too many times this season, but he's always a player that's annoyed me because I've had to see an awful lot of him. But he has been, in the past, he's kind of reminded me a bit of Kakuta Mane. He's just a lot of speed, a lot of huff and no puff.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this season, he really has a ton to prove, but I think he's already doing it to say, yeah, no, I can slot away those goals as well.
In the week after next, Canada is going to be playing a friendly against New Zealand, and they've announced a roster. If I have to complain about this the CCL situation, Vancouver got zero call. There were zero calls up to Vancouver for this game in Spain. Because they're playing, which may have something to do with the fact that they're playing LA on the same day.
I think we can safely say it does have something to do with that, because I think Carl Robinson's been quite vocal about his conversation with John Herdman, and if Herdman had a first test, it was to talk to domestic club coaches and try to convince them to release their players, and I think Robinson basically got on the phone and said no.
Yeah.
And Herdman went, okay.
And it's not even too much of it's not a huge put on for the other two teams either, because they don't play on that date. Toronto doesn't play until the 30th, so it's not even like there's a huge advantage for one team over the others. On the list, it's a pretty solid looking lineup. Mion Borjan is around in goal. I wanted to say how I see that Mark Anthony Kay is on the list, and I think that he's done great with his new role in LAFC, so that's been good to see. Mm-hmm. The Besiktas 2 of Atiba Hutchinson and Kyle Larin.
Boo. boo's for the latter one, not the former.
Oh, I'm ready. I'm ready for the Larin redemption story. I'm fine with it.
I want to see him red carded in the first match. I know I should be more patriotic, but I just really despise him as a human and as a player. The way that he left, he has everything to prove. And if those shoulders slump once more, I say, I want to see him done with the national team. But I know that's not going to happen. But Hutchinson's great.
Yeah.
But I do agree that the team overall looks good. I despite leaving all the Whitecaps off of it, I think that was a coach-to-coach decision. And I don't think the lineup suffers all that greatly from it, to be honest. Do you?
No. You mean the Orlando lineup for missing Larin?
No, sorry. I mean the Canada lineup.
From what?
For the friendly is like there's no Whitecaps present, but I'm like there sort of is.
Yes.
Sam Adekube is there. Like, what,
I mean, and David Edgar is present.
Yeah, which I also think is great. And I was like, well, so what? You don't have Davies or Tybert, but are those key players to that team right now? Like, Davies will get the experience at the club that he needs to get for the country.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I don't think there's too much of a story here, really. I think the same decisions could have been made regardless of the club matchups on the same day, and I don't think any people would have much to say about it, except everybody wants to see Davies play, but you've got to manage him properly, and I think it's probably right that given his Gold Cup exit and his recent success with Vancouver, let him ride that for a little bit. Let him get fit, let him enjoy it, let him get happy. And at this point, it means nothing. These are friendlies. Like,
yes,
you
know,
the World Cup is coming. You don't want to risk. Alphonso Davies is going to be a very important player for the Vancouver Whitecaps this season. You want to get him some national team minutes, but you don't want to risk him in a friendly game against New Zealand in a World Cup year while your club is also trying to build something.
You definitely don't. Especially not against New Zealand. Well, not to say that New Zealand, you know, I guess if you ever want to be in the, if you're looking at that half spot in qualifying, it's not like we'd never see New Zealand ever. But it is sort of a mid range game for Canada.
Yeah,
maybe that's too harsh on New Zealand, but
no, I don't think it is. I think we need to acknowledge that both teams are kind of in transition periods. They've achieved certain success and more success than they've had, but they're not going to be World Cup contenders anytime soon, and so you know they need to get a variety of players moving through and getting minutes, and they can't just rely on somebody like Alphonso Davies to come in and be the glory player. And you know he's had some success with them, but I don't even think he's, can we really say that he's the talisman that makes Canada click at this point? Like, you know, if you think about 8 years from now, he will be 25. That's a strong Canada team.
Yes,
hopefully with other additions. But when you see people like Piet included in the lineup and Hutchinson, and there's a good mix of ages, you go like, yeah, there's nothing wrong with this squad. It looks like as strong of a Canada squad as we've had.
Looks good. I had blanked out on you there for a moment because I was trying to find out more about the status of David Edgar, who is named in the team as unattached, despite having a decent... It's like, it's not even that it was a decent preseason. It was a well-publicized preseason with Vancouver. The club was happy to have him appear finally when he did appear in the preseason. So it's hard to know what's happening with him. I did find a completely unrelated real estate review for a Remax agent named David Edgar that's headlined, "I will recommend him to anyone," which is also
that is
true.
Also how I feel about the center back. It's not just because of the injury. You know, David Edgar's not an exciting, fun, young, sexy player, but I think he's done himself well, and especially after the horrible injury he had, I'm glad to see him getting an opportunity somewhere.
Mm-hmm. One other player that is getting an opportunity, and I just wanted to mention this, from the Canadian women's national team, is that goalkeeper Stephanie Labbe, most recently of the NWSL Spirit, is crossing over to men's club football to play in the PDL, is joining Calgary Foothills FC to try out for a spot on the team, is the way they've worded it to make it, you know, to ensure that people don't think that there's just sort of a handout, because obviously I think she would be one of the more famous players in the PDL, but that's really exciting to see. She cited Canadian hockey goalkeeper Shannon Zabados in doing so, and all the best to Labbe.
Yeah, pretty incredible story. And it's also kind of disappointing that it is 2018 and much gnawing of jaws will happen, and people, "Oh, well, but what happens if a ball hits her?" But it's exciting. I wish I was more optimistic about it opening the floodgates to something more, but it's very exciting for her.
I think it's a good point, and this is something that I say, this is nothing wrong with the, this is definitely not the fault of the Canadian Premier League push. You're creating something new. It's fine. But man, I wish it also kind of, do you think for you that it spotlights the lack of opportunities in women's football? Cause I feel like it's great. I'm definitely excited about it. You know, I wonder if there was more spots open that
You know what? I'm actually not that excited. I'm excited about it, but when you look at soccer across Canada, and there's certainly the numbers to back up the equality in Canada. I mean, women's soccer is massive across Canada, and actually has better support than the men's team. So it would be nice to see a similar push for them,
mm-hmm.
or certainly some integration there.
Yeah, you know, and you can't, I understand.
I watched a bunch of highlights of Christine Sinclair recently, and I was like, there's nothing about her style of play and her physicality that doesn't just scream Wondolowski. And I don't have a hard time imagining them on the same pitch, and I don't know why that's such an insane conversation to have.
Do you mean Sinclair playing with the man, or do you mean just being able to see more high-quality, more spots for our women's players?
I mean, just generally seeing more quality spots for women players and more opportunities afforded to them. That there's this still stigma of sort of like, yeah, I mean, it's good, but it's like, you know, but it's women's soccer.
Mm-hmm.
It's like there's a level of talent there that's far exceeding, and especially when you look at youth programs, the best young Canadian soccer talent is coming through the women's team, undoubtedly. And I just, however it manifests, I'd like to see more opportunities for it, and more opportunities to highlight that there, you know, we talk about Alphonso Davies, but how come we're not talking about Jordan Heidema, whose last name I'm probably butchering?
There was a piece of good news that almost escaped my mind. Equalizer Soccer posted a piece on March 2nd that I had seen, quoting multiple sources is saying that the Whitecaps are looking at 2019 to open an NWSL team that would play out of BC Place.
Hmm.
So that's I feel like right now, and this is my problem with the CPL, being excited about the CPL in general, is that you kind of have to wait, or like a lot of Canadian soccer news is that you kind of have to wait for things to actually come together before you can truly get hyped about it. But yeah. But that would be exciting.
Yeah, I think it would be so great. And I think where, you know, it's funny because if you're going to be the argument for how much time and effort and money was poured into the USL Whitecaps 2 franchise, can we not at least give the same effort to a women's team mm-hmm. playing at a higher level?
Yeah. And I mean, like, this is a great... going back to the quotes when Utah announced its women's team, it's just great to have the same sort of thought and care put into it.
Exactly. Yeah, which I think we can at least acknowledge that is clearly not what's happening right now.
Now
it's
here...
It's exciting that things could change.
I feel like we got to get out of here sooner or later, but I do want to ask you, if that was the case, what would you want to be called? Would you want it to be Whitecaps Women again, or would you come up with an equally Vancouverish name for it?
It's a good question. I would like to have a different name and a different identity because, you know, I don't know how much crossover with the teams there would ever actually be. And as exciting as some of the women's teams in Europe and the United States have been, I feel like the sort of there's always a condescension that happens with being like, well, it's Whitecaps Women.
Yes. You know,
it's like, it's Arsenal Ladies. Like, it just... They are professionals. They are great at their sport. I think they deserve a name that represents that. I get wanting to tie it in with a club identity. I think there's good examples of the NWSL that's done that.
Mm-hmm.
I think the Pride in Orlando have done that exceptionally well.
The piece in Equalizer points to the Thorns as sort of what the club is looking at, which I think is a great example of a team that's been able to exist within the club hierarchy but create its own identity. And I have a lot of misgivings about how things went down with the W League team that folded in 2012. And yeah. I still miss it. I still have my Vancouver Whitecaps women's team shirt that mm-hmm. I bought from when they visited Penticton, BC. But if they are targeting even the decision to have it be in BC Place as opposed to being in a smaller venue or elsewhere as they had at one point playing their home games around the province, that... If they're looking at the Thorns, they're already so far ahead of where they were in 2012.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, the thing about, like, look, they're going to draw more fans than a BC Lions game. So, like, let's give them their own identity. Let's be real, though. No, I'm actually serious.
Yeah, no,
like,
you're I shouldn't have laughed so hard.
No,
it's a good to get the Lions, but still.
You're right to laugh, but I am serious in that I think we've surpassed the mark now. We could say, like, the only sold-out soccer audience that's ever been in BC Place was for the women's national team. Now, yes, it was the women's national team, but clearly there's an appetite for it. When you look at the amount of women's soccer that is happening across our country, like, it's going to take a team that sticks its neck out a little bit and raises it to a platform. You could be risk adverse and want to start out small, but I think there's a really good argument to be made for how much hunger there is for women's soccer across the country, especially mm-hmm. in Vancouver, that you go, I don't think they'd have any problem putting 10, 15,000 bums in seats to watch games. But give them the... If you brand them as this sort of Whitecaps 2 sort of underneath, below the actual team thing, then it's going to be harder to draw people. So find a brand that aligns with the Whitecaps and doesn't seem like a totally different entity. But as you pointed out, you've got the Portland Timbers and the Portland Thorns, and they sort of fit well together. You can support both without having to do too much homework about switching leagues or sides.
I think that the success of women's national team friendlies, the success of the Women's World Cup final, and the success also, the perennial success I'm seeing of rugby sevens games in BC Place is showing that there is a sports market in Vancouver that is a little more immune to concerns about, like, oh, this isn't, you know, the NFL. You know what I mean? Right? Like that is more open-minded.
Absolutely. And I mean, it sounds kind of crude and capitalist in a sense, but you think about, like, do you think you're really going to have that much trouble if you have a exciting young Canadian player? Like if you have the frenzy around Davies, well, he's also an accessible player and you can buy a shirt. There's four or five young Canadian women coming up that are going to be the next Christine Sinclairs. Christine Sinclair is the tip of the iceberg.
Yeah.
And as a legend as she is, and take no respect away from her for her achievements, she's the tip of the iceberg. And we're going to see young Canadian women surpass what she's achieved in our lifetime. Mm-hmm. The difference is that people can't easily go and see those games or buy those jerseys. And so when you think about who young women have to look up to, I think there's a strong case to be made for it. Like, this is an easily scalable venture if you are just looking at key business indicators. There's a market
key business there. Indicators.
And even if there wasn't a market there, there's every reason in the world to support this if we want to truly compete on a national level with other teams. Mm-hmm. But there is a market there. And I'm very excited to see what happens. And, I'd be thrilled to see a season tickets package offered for a women's team in Vancouver.
You haven't answered my question, though, which is what you would call it.
I don't know.
Tweet us your suggestions for the name of the team. You can tweet them to Nick. Where can they do that, Nick?
At That's So MLS on Twitter. I also just want to add, I avoided that question because Whitecaps isn't a particularly good team name. I tried to avoid saying it.
Ooh, that's an uncomfortable truth.
Is it the ocean or the mountains? No one knows. It's both. There's nothing. What is time? What is space? And where can we find you online, good sir?
You can find me at Team Bates, www.team-bates.com. You can find my soccer writing at littlerubberpellets.com. And I'm an editor at Howler at whatahowler.com. You can find this podcast at thatsomls.com. And you can subscribe on iTunes, which please do, and leave us a review.
Yeah, please do that thing. Recently, there's been a pickup in the number of people listening, and which is exciting, but also has led me to kind of into a place of, like, what do people like about it?
Well, welcome. I'm curious. Welcome.
I need your love to be qualified with words and stars.
We welcome you all here. I'm very excited you've joined us, and tweet all of your thoughts to both of us. And
to Nick.
And we'll be happy to engage you wherever that happens.
Indeed. As Terry Dunfield did this week, when I pointed out that I used to work with his aunt.
And as the Whitecaps did when you bet.
Oh, shit. Okay. Can we briefly do that before we sign off?
Yeah.
Because we need to...
Yeah, we almost got all the way through before we remembered that you bet that we would buy the Whitecaps beer?
Yeah, okay. So, in a moment of weakness, in a moment of our team won and I was feeling sassy, the Vancouver Whitecaps social media crew released the, like, and that's a wrap, we won the game. And they had Toronto's logo and we beat them 2-1. And so, of course, being the good fan that I am, immediately tweeted back being like, I think there's something wrong here. If this is the final scoreline against Toronto, I'll buy you all beer. And then forgot about it and came back later and was like, oh shit, they've responded. Which normally they don't do. And so long story short, if Vancouver beats Toronto, and I don't care what the scoreline is, I feel like in good faith, if Vancouver beats Toronto this season, you and I do in fact own the Whitecaps front office beer.
Well, I'm gonna be there, so I guess I gotta figure something out because I do intend on attending that away fixture.
I've got it covered, man. Their All sponsor right. in the stadium is Budweiser. I can afford cans of Budweiser. Not in BC Place, but at a liquor store, I can afford that.
Oh, we missed this. There was a funny and this is the outro that never ends. Because of that Budweiser sponsorship. Oh no, you did mention this last time. We can buy beers for everybody but Alphonso Davies. What?
Yeah, that's right. Alphonso Davies is excluded, but the entire front. We didn't really establish what the Whitecaps office meant.
Yeah.
Maybe it's just the Twitter team. I'm hoping it's just the social media team.
Backpedal.
I did point out that our team was only two people and that our office is our living rooms, but I'll... Scout's honor, I will hold true to this, but it will be Budweiser.
Sure.
If it's the entire team and entire front office, it's going to be Budweiser, and it's going to be from BCL, not from the stadium.
Well,
if we beat Toronto 2-1, I will be so elated. I will buy everybody two Budweisers.
Oh, of course. I will be buying. I will also assist with the purchase of those Budweisers, both for the team and for myself.
All the things we do.
We will catch you up on that as the season develops. And in the meantime, Nick, don't get sent.
Yeah, I'll try not to. Oh, dear.